You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Katie Putz, recording in Washington, D.C.
And this is Ankit Panda, also in Washington, D.C.
So earlier this month, Nepal became the latest South Asian country to see a dramatic wave of protests and the initial violent state response to those protests unseat a government. Nepal's domestic turmoil this month echoes the unrest that overthrew the Hasina regime in Bangladesh in August 2024 and the protests that ushered the Rajapaksa family out of power in Sri Lanka in 2022. So Ankit, let's get into this a little bit. You know, this might seem a little bit outside of our usual Asia geopolitics remit, but I think there's a lot here. You know, on September 8th, there were clashes between security forces and students, mostly in Kathmandu, that left 19 people dead. That sort of triggered wider protests across the country. And the proximate trigger for these protests, right, was a recent government order to shut down a host of social media platforms. But it's abundantly clear that this was about more than access to Instagram and TikTok. You know, Ankit, looking at these protests, you know, were you surprised to see this in Nepal? And what do you think some of those underlying causes might be?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think this was definitely surprising when it broke out, but the pace at which things moved also, I think, was pretty remarkable, right? In the case of Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, you had processes that really played out over months, in the case of Bangladesh, with also a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. But in Nepal, essentially, what we see is the pressure that had built up over frustration, primarily among the youth, right? A lot of people are calling this Nepal's kind of Gen Z revolution. Frustration building up among kind of over corruption and particularly nepotism, paired against the backdrop of what I guess many of the country's disaffected youth have felt is a lack of economic opportunity. So it's a pretty classic recipe for essentially what appears to be a full-scale revolution in the country. And, you know, just to put this in broader context, Nepal's history post-1990 has really been marked by, you know, three major periods like this. You had the 1990 revolution, which brought in constitutional monarchy in the country, the 2006 revolution that ended monarchy altogether, and then now this appears to be the next transition. And so the questions going forward are, will this effectively transition Nepal into a different phase in its democracy, which is going to be hopefully one that addresses some of the corruption concerns that certainly are real, but, you know, the violence, of course, has also given the Nepalese military a prominent role in responding to this. So lots to kind of think about there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the, you know, a lot gets made of youth sort of obsession with social media, but I think so the social media question and the platform question really reflects sort of the use of those platforms, both for political commentary. You know, the Nepali youth were tweeting and showing videos and sort of exposing some of the disparity between the elite in Nepal and sort of the average people. And it was on those platforms that people were sort of politically organizing. And so shutting those platforms off is a bit of, you know, a red flag for that reason. But also, I think it's worth sort of bringing up and mentioning sort of the fact that Nepal is one of the most remittance dependent countries in the world. You know, a significant portion of the Nepali population is outside of the country working, sending money back, and they use these platforms to connect with their families. So it sort of is also reflective of just a real an own goal in a way, you know, that I think this could have been sort of predicted in a way as being particularly inflammatory. And all of that, however, comes back to that economic question. You know, youth unemployment in Nepal, I looked this up yesterday, in 2024, it was as high as 20%. And the overall unemployment rate in Nepal is around 10%. So these are pretty high figures. And I think when we look at some of the other similar circumstances elsewhere in South Asia, that is a theme, sort of youth unemployment, overall unemployment, and a real disparity between the elite and sort of your average person. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk a little bit about the geopolitical implications of not just instability broadly in Nepal, but, you know, we can also revisit the broader trend lines that we've seen around South Asia, which really primarily has been a concern for India, right? India is the major natural, or at least sees itself as the natural center of gravity in this region, surrounded by a number of smaller countries that it's tried to maintain primarily stability with to protect its own borders and sort of address some of those concerns. So The response in the Indian media, among the Indian commentariat, has been interesting, right? You have everything from, you know, conspiracy theories that what's happening in Nepal is kind of a color revolution, for lack of a better term, instigated by foreign forces, and really kind of refusing to maybe fully contend with the domestic drivers of this. And then meanwhile, you know, we have to also acknowledge that India has historically, of course, had very close economic, cultural, you know, diplomatic ties with Nepal. There's free travel across the Nepal-India border, so a lot of economic activity that occurs across that border. So the consequences of this revolution, I think, will be deeply concerning to New Delhi. And then, of course, there's the geographic position of Nepal, which is literally sandwiched between China and India, although with the Himalayas serving as a bit of a natural barrier that limits the ability of cross-border interactions with China directly. But of course, as we've just discussed recently on this podcast, this revolution is taking place against the backdrop of what appears to be a thaw in China-India ties that had also been rather chilly for the last 5 years. So how the two countries, the two major powers, will sort of approach whatever comes next in Nepal, I think, is an open question.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, you can't forget the fact that Nepal is sort of balanced between these two massive neighbors, right? But I think on the China angle, there was a lot of discussion and plans in the last decade regarding BRI projects in Nepal. They haven't really come to fruition. The promise has not really yielded results. And I think I haven't seen that sort of cited as a reason for the unrest, and I don't think it is, but it feeds into that larger economic question, which is Nepal's leaders didn't figure out how to make the economy work in a way that benefited everybody. And the things they did try, BRI, didn't really pan out. And, you know, I think we'll have to see where this goes. So, you know, just to catch our listeners up, you know, after these protests on September 9th, so the day after the first bits of violence, the prime minister resigned. A couple days later, the death toll had sort of risen toward the 50s. And honestly, what I thought was a kind of remarkable sort of turn of events is Nepali activists used Discord to discuss and debate next steps and sort of proposed a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Sushila Karki, to be an interim chief. And then they engaged with sort of talks with the army chief, and Karki was sworn in as the prime minister with a 6-month mandate. And there should be elections in March 2026, and we'll see how the major political parties in Nepal deal with this, because in the last 15 years, just since the promulgation of the 2015 constitution, there have been three guys who have been prime minister just on like a rotating basis. And none of them seem to have like cracked the nut on how to deal with this issue. And so, you know, will there be new parties? Will there be new ideas? We'll have to see where that comes from. But I think certainly Nepal's neighbors are going to be watching carefully. And there is a question for India, which does have a lot of connections and a lot of influence in Nepal. You know, what does this say about the value of Indian partnership, that Nepal's economy is in the state that it's in, its political economy is in the state that it's in, and India is such a large force on the sort of horizon?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you mentioned the promulgation of the 2015 constitution. I mean, in the lead up to that process, there was quite a bit of tension between India and Nepal over what was perceived to be India being rather forward leaning diplomatically on what the Nepalis considered rightfully to be an internal matter. So I think one of the questions here, too, for India will be how forward leaning will New Delhi be? And I think this is really an interesting open question, because on the one hand, you know, India might sort of learn some of the lessons of that 2015-2016 period that arguably led to closer ties between Nepal and China, although some would argue that those ties would have developed regardless, given the disposition of the Nepali leadership. But alternatively, looking at what's happened in Bangladesh, for instance, where there's been quite a bit of Indian geopolitical hand-wringing over the transition away from the Sheikh Hasina government towards Muhammad Yunus and a new coalition in Bangladesh, there may be another push to try and ensure that whatever outcome does manifest in Nepal is favorable to Indian interests. So I think that, too, is going to be an important geopolitical flashpoint to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point regarding the 2015-2016 sort of, it's interesting that you mentioned in the sort of Indian commentariat about the current situation. There's the classic, you know, color revolution. This is externally instigated. The country with the most influence in Nepal is India. And I'm not saying that India instigated this. I genuinely think that the Nepali youth had had enough. They seized an opportunity, and they had seen and probably had learned from Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, and watching how those protests and those revolutions worked out, and what they did that succeeded and what maybe didn't work. But, you know, it sort of makes me want to misquote Shakespeare, you know, the lady doth protest too much. And so, you know, it will be interesting to see how India handles this, because in the Bangladesh case, right, like Sheikh Hasina fled to India. I don't know where the Nepali prime minister is going to end up. I believe he's still in Nepal, or it might be unclear, but it would not be shocking if he ended up in India. And so we'll have to see how they handle that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of open questions here, right? I mean, the key issue, right, the core driver of this corruption, that's kind of the big question, you know. Does whatever comes next in Nepal actually address the key environment that caused this in the first place, sort of divides between political elites and, you know, people that feel like they're completely detached from whatever economic opportunities and growth are opening up in the country. So I think that remains really unclear to me. I mean, it seems more likely that corruption will endure. You know, my understanding is one of the reasons that the Discord election opted for Sushila Karki was her role in sort of some of the anti-corruption judgments. So that, I think, is going to be the big one to watch for. But I mean, the key geopolitical question, I think, with all of these states in South Asia around India, you know, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, obviously all of these countries have their domestic politics to work through that cause these regimes to collapse. I mean, a lot of these, you know, in the cases of the Rajapaksas and Hasina, entrenched sort of dynastic leaders that had been dominant in the country's politics for a long time. But as they sort of leave the scene, it's unclear if those countries will fundamentally change their geopolitical disposition. And I think that is the key question going forward, right? I mean, to simplify things, there's really three possible outcomes. One is India maintains its role as the natural center of gravity, and these countries gravitate towards New Delhi for economic reasons. That's potentially part of the case for Sri Lanka, less so for Bangladesh, which has grown further from India. Alternatively, these countries could pursue a multi-aligned or non-aligned approach of their own, or they could look towards China or alternative external parties. And I think this is going to be the key thing to watch in Nepal going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. How these countries and really whatever political forces emerge, because, you know, Nepal is supposed to have elections, I think, early March 2026 now, 6 months. You know, there are entrenched political interests. We'll see how far, you know, how far down the political ladder sort of blame will go for the current situation. Will there be new parties that emerge? That's some of the stuff that I'm watching to see if the sort of Gen Z movement can make the transition into sort of traditional political arenas without losing what it is that led them to this point. And we'll certainly be paying attention. Unless you've got some final thoughts, I think we can probably call it a day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this was a good way to kind of make sure that our listeners have an update on what's been going on in South Asia, because it's been really remarkable to just watch this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when the history of the last sort of decade in South Asia is written, there'll be some interesting chapters on all of these countries that from a geopolitical perspective look small, but clearly have a position in the world and have, you know, influence on what happens in other places. And so that's my constant shout out for the small states. But thanks for listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics podcast. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you listen to podcasts so you don't miss out on future episodes. And remember, you can also get in touch with Ankit or myself with episode suggestions or questions. We'll be back soon with more.